Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated October 11. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first article, Top of the Fold, Stifles Pour Millions into Health Research, by Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. Many standards, Charles and Deneen Stifle, have eased into retirement nicely. They travel regularly and make frequent visits to see their grandchildren, who are spread between Raleigh and Seattle. Deneen has birds who seemingly depend on her for daily lunches, and the couple gladly welcomes guests by offering them a warm cup of coffee or a glass of cool water when they visit. But in other ways, their retirement has been out of the norm. Not everyone retires after selling a pharmaceutical company to GlaxoSmithKline in a deal valued at $3.6 billion. Retiring in this way has allowed the couple to expand its philanthropy. Duke University in August announced a $1.3 million gift from the Stifles to further study a group of diseases that increase the risk of lymphoma. That line of research at Duke was initiated by another gift from the Stifles, a $650,000 donation in 2011. At the MD Anderson Cancer Center, part of the University of Texas, the Stifles donated $10 million to the Head and Neck Cancer Center. In their honor, MD Anderson named the center after the couple. Although these were obviously happy announcements for Charles and Deneen, their interactions with MD Anderson and other cancer centers haven't always been pleasurable. Charles was treated for neck cancer at MD Anderson and has family members who have died because of various cancers. One of their sons lives with common variable immunity deficiency, CVID, which is an area of focus in the Duke research. Charles is now cancer-free, making it easier for the couples to talk about, but cancer has brought many speed bumps, Deneen says. Charles says he believes that families have certain genetic weak spots that predispose them to illness. Cancer is our weak spot, he says, which clearly plays a role in his desire to fund cancer research. His former company, Stifle Laboratories, developed and sold prescription skin products, and Stifle has been in the dermatology world most of his life. It's only natural that the couple also works closely with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society and helps young dermatologists enter the career field. Although he is retired, Charles has left the door cracked to start his career up again. He has served as a consultant to various companies and thought about starting up a new company. He had a non-compete clause with GSK, a commonality in acquisition contracts, but that has expired. He incorporated a new company, but hasn't decided if he wants to actively build on it. I'm not committed, he says. It depends on how the landscape develops. For now, he says he's enjoying semi-retirement. For her part, Deneen says she is fully retired and plans to stay that way. Charles still reads many of the academic journals on dermatology and attends various conferences around the world. Naturally, Deneen travels with him, so while she is indeed fully retired, she is still connected to the dermatology business, or at least tangentially. GSK kept the Stifle name in no small part because of its long history in the dermatology market. It was founded in 1847, but fell on hard times in the 1930s and essentially ceased. In 1944, Charles' father and uncle started the company up again, but lost money for the first 7 years. Charles and Deneen met at age 7. Charles grew up near the Catskill Mountains in New York, where Deneen's New Jersey family would vacation. Their romantic relationship didn't blossom until college. Deneen attended Douglas College in New Jersey, and Charles studied at Yale. They began dating during their sophomore year and have now been married 41 years. Deneen graduated with degrees in psychology and sociology and became a social worker, while Charles began practicing law. He said he always knew he wanted to work for the company founded by his family in 1847, but wanted to prove himself first. He started with Stifel Labs in 1980 as general counsel when the company had grown to $20 million in sales. By 2001, when Charles' father retired and he took over as chairman, the company had grown to $250 million in sales with 2,000 employees. "I wanted to increase U.S. sales dramatically," he said, adding that his goal was to reach $1 billion in sales as quickly as possible. Heading into 2009, Stifel Labs budgeted $1 billion in sales, and though it reached only $900 million, something Charles blames on the economic crisis, it had caught the eye of the big pharma companies. Sanofi Aventis approached Charles in 2008, and he agreed to listen. Although his father's attitude had typically been to simply reject an acquisition offer, "I felt as CEO it was my job to at least listen," he says. He let other companies know he was at least willing to listen to an offer. "And it turned out that Glaxo made an amazing offer," he says, "leading to a relatively smooth acquisition process that the Stifel shareholders unanimously approved." Next up, this week's cover story, The STEM Gap. The Triangle and the nation's women make little inroads in leadership in STEM occupations. By Lauren K. Onisorge. From the Research Triangle Park. Visitors to Myra Halpern's chemistry classroom in the North Carolina School of Science and Math would likely find as many girls as boys bent over their beakers and calculators. Graduate-level science labs at Triangle Universities are similarly gender-neutral, with about 40% of PhDs in science, technology, engineering, and math, also known as STEM, disciplines occupied by women. But out in the corporate world, women are still very much underrepresented in leadership positions among STEM occupations. While women make up half of the workforce across all jobs, they hold a mere one-fourth of the STEM jobs. And that number dwindles even further when it comes to holding positions of power and influence. The Triangle is no different than the rest of the country. Only five women remain at the helm of the area's largest companies. Of the top 25 highest-paid CEOs of the Triangle biotechnology companies in 2012, two were women. Furthermore, of the top 100 public companies in North Carolina, three had women at the helm in 2012, and just 22 women occupy the Fortune 500 list. For most women, the proverbial glass ceiling is secure and, in fact, may be getting thicker. Policymakers and school officials, both state and national, are taking steps to encourage a wider educational pipeline for STEM study. And an increased enrollment by both male and females would indicate those efforts are paying off. But it could take decades for business and tenure academic regimes to catch up. Experts don't expect the glass ceiling to shatter anytime soon. Just ask Nancy Hopkins, molecular biologist and soon-to-be-retired biology professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In the 1990s, she penned a report that shocked science. "The press picked it up, and it appeared on the front page of the New York Times," she recalls. The report was a summary that would soon be called the glass ceiling. Observations that only 15 women were tenured in the six departments at MIT. Compare that to the 197 tenured men at the time. That was 1999. The discovery, she says, was there was a universal problem, the undervaluation of equal work when it was done by a woman. Hopkins, 70, says it took her 20 years to accept what was going on was very odd and not okay. "When I tried to explain it to people, women who hadn't taken this high-level career path, they didn't know what I was talking about," she says. But that was then. By 2013, Hopkins and her counterparts envisioned progress. That's why a second study conducted at Yale University last year was so jarring. The report revealed that not much has changed since the Hopkins study published more than a decade before. "It's just astonishing," she says. The paper, authored by then-Yale postdoc Corinne Moss Rasmussen and others, prompted a similar firestorm again on the cover of the New York Times. Deja vu, Hopkins says. "A lot of important conversations are being had since this paper was published," says Moss Rasmussen, now an assistant professor of psychology at Skidmore College. "The underlying bias is still present, and this sort of research is necessary to move us forward." But in the 1990s, Hopkins said, Important conversations were happening from her report. What are the conversations going to, when are the conversations going to shatter the ceiling? It's really sad that 10 years after a study very similar comes up with similar disappointing results, says Silva Tromisca at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, anthropologist and head of the Women in Science program. She doesn't expect shards of glass to rain on us anytime soon. We can't expect the scientific world to change if the world around us isn't changing. That's asking too much of the women going into the scientific world. She says women have elevated expectations placed upon them and that it shouldn't surprise you. If you have a career, you're still expected to do a lot of the household chores and childcare and work, she says. And most scientific research, you are tied to your lab or field work. It's very time-consuming and leaves limited time for families. Many of the women in sciences don't have children or have children later in life. Tomaskova says the industries need to be more accommodating, adding that home and work life don't have to be separate entities. UNC, she notes, doesn't have an on-campus child care center. If we had a more family-friendly environment, I think more women would decide to go into science, she says. Many more of us would realize that we are complex human beings that also have families. And the stereotype doesn't just put women in the kitchen. It also shapes how society views leadership, she says, noting that a typical CEO is described with words such as aggressive. Women shirk away from that kind of presentational self because we still view women as, well, you name the words that you would label them with when you think aggressive, she says, adding that a leader can be a nice negotiator, and society still needs to recognize that type of CEO. But the big picture simply isn't about individual women being unable to advance, cautions Moss Rakusen. It's a study in competitiveness. It's really critical, she says. We need our scientific fields to be functioning at the best possible level. Our national competitiveness hangs in the balance. When scientific standards of meritocracy are rejected and male candidates are advanced over their sometimes more qualified female counterparts, the best research isn't being recognized. And that could absolutely put Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, and the nation at a disadvantage in an ever-competitive world. But not every woman lets the glass ceiling stand in the way. Take Paula Brown Stafford at Durham-based Quintiles, who was one of four female students concentrating on biostatistics at UNC. Now she heads clinical development for the Global Contract Research Organization. I had a good education behind me, she says. I had a good experience. I never felt stopped because I was a woman. I felt very fortunate to have chosen the field that I chose because I think it put me in a very solid position to do well. And Michelle Sanders, who heads the Research Triangle Park Operations for Drug Development Biogen IDEC, is another good example. Saunders, who grew up curious with a father who was a math teacher, says she first realized the ceiling existed in college. I realized in college that the majority of my courses, there weren't many females, and especially as I got into the higher level courses, she says. One course that stood out to me was physics. I was the only female, and that one just really resonated and stood out to me. Ann Whitaker is another success story. Whitaker, who started in sales at GlaxoSmithKline in the Research Triangle Park, is now head of the North American operations at a global drug giant, Sanofi, and began her science trek early as a child experimenting with bottle rockets. The daughter of a NASA employee, she went from spending weekends mixing up concoctions in my grandfather's kitchen to college where suddenly she realized the stereotypes existed. Initially, when she enrolled at the University of Northern Alabama, she had wanted to go to medical school. I had a professor that sat down with me, and I had done well in my chemistry classes, but I didn't do great in my first physics class, she says, recalling the first time she made a C grade on a midterm. He said, "You know, we have a great teacher's college here. Maybe you should think about becoming a chemistry teacher." I remember sitting across from the table. I can see him right now. I was just thinking, wait a minute. Why should I want to do that? She remembers leaving the room incredulous. While that wasn't the end of her science story, the memory plays in her mind like a barrier. I just kind of put that out of my head and did what I wanted to do, she says. And that's what RTP's female leaders all have in common, a willfulness. The kind of character trait that PNC Bank Regional President Paula Freiland used to get her bosses to help her rearrange her schedule so she could spend more time with her children. "You ask for what you want," she says. Ping Fu, founder of Morrisville-based 3D software firm Geomagic, a 3D systems company, says she never let herself hear no and says it's about being motivated. Girls, she adds, need to be motivated away from the looking pretty stereotype and realize that science isn't just a subject in school. It's an opportunity, she explains. How can North Carolina motivate girls and instill that willful spirit? Stafford says girls and children in general need to be exposed to science career paths. That, she suspects, is the first step. When I grew up, it was, are you going to be a nurse, a doctor, a fireman, a postal worker, and at that time, a milkman? She says no one talked about biostatistician. We have to get young ladies in middle school as well as high school to let them know about the opportunities out there. Whitaker says a lack of role models is part of the problem. If you look at the universities and you look at the profession that are in the math and the science area, the majority are men, she says. Christy Schaefer, a venture partner at Hatteras Venture Partners and former CEO of Inspire Pharmaceuticals, says it's also a perception problem with women, and people in general, not understanding how cool science is. The current generation often finds science too hard or too boring, she says, adding that that's why she thinks it's important to support programs such as the North Carolina School of Science and Math. Children have to be excited to be engaged, and there's no time to waste. Local leaders agree that breaking that ceiling is vital, not just in RTP, but in the world. I believe that within the STEM area is where we'll find many solutions to healthcare issues and environmental issues, Sanders says. I believe that this is the field many of those solutions will come from, and it is important for us to be at the table and be part of those discussions. Continuing on the discussion of STEM, Durham School Nurtures Love of Math and Science, also by Lauren K. Onisorge, and this article's from Durham. Savannah Swinney and Claire Nembrodery are concocting something. A liquid bubbles in a glass beaker on a burner, carefully monitored by Swinney, who pencils a number into a notebook. With surroundings like these, a dark lab desk, plastic goggles, and serious expressions, they could be mistaken for scientists conducting life-saving research in the heart of RTP. Maybe someday. Swinney and Nembrodery are two of 680 students at the Durham-based North Carolina School of Science and Math, a place where the students claim the glass ceiling doesn't exist. Probably from an early age, I was always interested in math and science, says Swinney, who hopes to have a career in environmental science. I always liked numbers a lot. She, unlike many older counterparts, has never felt limited by gender. Nor has Nembrodery, who envisions a future in neurology. Never, she says. But that's today. Amy Sheck, Dean of Science at North Carolina School of Science and Math, says that can change. It does change as you get older, she says. They get married. They have babies. They go to grad school. There's so many opportunities for the sexism to start. But at least we can start them on a level playing field. That's what the North Carolina School of Science and Math does, brings kids interested in science to a place where their ideas will be fostered. Here, female students actually outnumber male students. And here you'll find female science professors, such as Marion Brisk, who has taught for 42 years, including a tenure at the City College of New York. She's seen changes. When I was in school, I wanted to be a vet. But there was no chance, she laughs, recalling when, as an undergrad, women started being admitted into medical and law school. It was seen as taking a spot of a man. Myra Halpern, who's been teaching chemistry for 24 years at the school, however, does see traces of that ceiling, however camouflaged, by an enthusiastic student body. While female students here excel at the academics of science and math, the struggle is in the application, she says, pointing to an entrepreneurship program at the school where, last year, out of five teams, only one female student applied. I don't think they have role models, she says. I don't know that they have seen enough examples so they can combine science and business and economics. For students to want to grow up to be CEOs, they need to have CEOs to relate to, she says. Right now, there just aren't that many, she points out. The numbers do show the interest in science is present early. In schools overall, boys represented 51% of students taking advanced sciences, with girls at 49%. In college, however, 31% of the degrees and certificates in STEM fields were earned by women, according to the United States Department of Education. Women held 41% of the PhDs in STEM fields. The biggest gap happens after their education. While women made up 48% of the workforce in 2009, they filled only 24% of the STEM jobs. Next up, Reichhold, IEM, plan on moving central offices, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from the Research Triangle Park. The world headquarters for two prominent local companies will soon be moving, but lucky for the Triangle market, they won't be moving far. The Reichhold Chemical and Resins Company, based in the Research Triangle Park, and the IEM risk management firm that relocated to RTP in 2010, will be moving out of their offices at the 2400 Ellis Road building in January, leaving the 335,000 square foot building empty in their wake. Reichhold will be moving into a 112,000 square foot former GlaxoSmithKline laboratory building at 1035 Swaiba Court. And that's been empty since 2011, confirms Joan Grace, a spokesperson for Reichhold. IEM will be relocating its headquarters as well, says IEM's Stacy Boudreaux, but the company hasn't finalized its new office location yet. Our lease is up at the end of January, but that's all that there's been done so far, she says. IEM, the smaller of the two tenants, is leasing about 15,000 square feet at the Ellis Road building and will be relocating to a similar size space in the Triangle for the company's 60 employees in the region, she says. Reichhold's move is necessary, Grace says, because the company is no longer needs a building of its size, a building that was built to Reichhold specifications in 1992 after the company relocated its headquarters from Michigan. This building is too big for us, she says. We've had reductions in downsizing like everybody else, and it saves us a lot of money going to this other building that's more suitable for our size. So we're moving on. The relocation should be complete by January 12, she says. Reichhold, a privately owned company led by CEO John Gaither, employs about 106 people in RTP and 1,400 people worldwide, which is way down from its peak in the early 2000s when Reichhold employed about 450 people in RTP and 3,500 people worldwide before it sold off its adhesives and latex product divisions. But despite those reductions, Reichhold is still one of the largest suppliers of unsaturated polyester resins that are used to make cultured marble countertops, fiberglass boats, wind turbine blades, and other everyday products. Reichhold's RTP headquarters also has researchers and staff for one of its three major research and development labs. The other two are in Brazil and Norway. It also has 20 manufacturing plants, but none are in North Carolina. Reichhold earlier this year closed a manufacturing facility in Newark, New Jersey, due to damage by Superstorm Sandy, but it also opened a new manufacturing plant in China in 2012. The company has annual sales of around $1 billion. Continuing on, Walgreens charts layoffs at Car Drug after buy. This article is also by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Raleigh. The Car Drug Pharmacy chain is already preparing its staff for the heavy blow that will hit the company's corporate headquarters on Spring Forest Road in North Raleigh next year after the company's sale to Walgreens is complete. Car Drug will eliminate 84 job positions next year once the transition is complete, according to a Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification WARN Act letter sent to the North Carolina Department of Commerce just a few days ago. The layoffs will be effective August 29, 2014, when the company expects to close its corporate office at 3220 Spring Forest Road, according to the letter from Brioni Voorhees, Car Drug's Vice President of Human Resource. Voorhees noted that the closing is happening because of the company's pending sale to Walgreens. Walgreens announced it earlier September it would be acquiring CarDrug's 76 stores and specialty pharmacy business. At that time, CarDrug employed 1,600 employees. The transaction with Deerfield, Illinois-based Walgreens is expected to close later this year, but the terms of the deal have not been disclosed. CarDrug will retain ownership of its long-term care pharmacy business. Most of the jobs impacted are positions related to the corporate and back-office operations of the company, including CarDrug's chief executive officer, chief financial officer, finance and accounting staff, facility services staff, and employee training staff. In recent days, Walgreens executives made another move following its CarDrug acquisition announcement last month. The 160,000-worker drugstore, the largest in the nation, announced that it would transition its employees to a private health insurance exchange. The company said its employees could purchase health insurance through the exchange run by Aon Health and would subsidize some of the costs. Jefferies and Company analyst Mark Wiltemuth, who initiated research on Walgreens on October 8th, said in his initial report that the company is in the midst of the biggest era of change in drugstores history. After taking a 45% stake in Alliance Boots and striking a 10-year drug distribution and joint sourcing pact with AmerisourceBergen, now the hard work begins on synergies and execution, writes Wiltemuth. Currently, Walgreens Company shares a trading near its 52-week high of $57.41 a share. This week's column of commercial and residential real estate is by Amanda Hoyle, and she writes to us about new built-ins, including espresso makers and dog spas. Every year, the best way to find out what new design features and add-ons Triangle Home Builders are incorporating into their new home projects across the region is to go on the Parade of Homes tour. And fortunately, both of the annual parade tours organized by the Home Builders Association of Raleigh, Wake County, and the Home Builders Association of Durham, Orange, and Chatham counties run simultaneously each weekend during the month of October. This year, nearly 250 newly built homes are featured on the parade tours, with prices ranging from $115,000 to nearly $2.3 million. But what if you're looking for ideas to improve your current home or to incorporate into your next home? Here are some of the coolest add-ons we found in this year's parade home. Number 1. Built-in coffee makers, espresso machines. A Bosch stainless steel coffee maker, like the one found at the Briar Chapel community in Chapel Hill, could cost nearly $2,000 to install, but we're told it's an indulgence you can quickly become accustomed to. Most systems have a plumbed-in water connection, an integrated milk tank, and frothing system. Number 2. Car garage with a mechanic's car lift. For the true do-it-yourselfer mechanic, this means no more jacks and jack stands or squeezing under a car for service. According to popular mechanics, auto lifts have become much easier to install and more affordable at $1,500 for a base-level lift. In Raleigh, check out the Stuart M. Jones Custom Homes House on Faircloth Street. Number 3. Custom shower and mutt room for dogs. Indoor washing stations for dogs and other pets are becoming more popular for those who want to invite man's best friends inside. JM Custom Homes incorporated this custom shower in its 3-level home recently completed in Raleigh's Rose Hill community. Number 4. The in-law suite. For those parents or long-term visitors who may want their own private space, several local home builders like Ashton Woods Homes and Lennar are offering a floor plan with a separate in-law suite, complete with its own entrance, bedroom, bathroom, kitchenette, and living space. This week's column by Jason DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. This week's column is entitled Vinsel Primed for WakeMed Search. As Doug Vinsel readies to help steer WakeMed Health and Hospitals towards a new CEO hire, he says he's ready to reacquaint himself with old coworkers, meet new ones, and do what's best not only for WakeMed, but for the healthcare landscape in Wake County. I know that the organization has fallen on harder times, but I would say that 1 year or 2 years is not a trend, he says. This is a great market, and I have every confidence in the hospital and its board. Bensel was hired as Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at WakeMed in 1984. He kept that same title for 22 years before moving up the road to Duke Raleigh Hospital as its Chief Executive, a role he held for 7 years before retiring in 2012. WakeMed's CEO, Bill Atkinson, left the hospital shortly before it entered its new fiscal year on October 1st. The board and Atkinson agreed that they had differing ideas about the direction of the hospital should go. It posted its first operating loss in years for the fiscal year ended on September 30th and has already budgeted a break-even operating budget this year. Bensel says he was approached by the WakeMed board and is not interested in actually becoming the interim or full-time CEO of WakeMed. "I retired with a purpose, and I'm enjoying my retirement," he says. In the medical community, Bensel is seen as someone more friendly towards doctors than Atkinson was perceived to be. While he stayed away from comparing the two CEOs, Dr. Tim Garner, a neurosurgeon who helps cover the emergency room at WakeMed, says he's always appreciated Bensel's willingness to listen to doctors and explain himself if he must decline a request. "He listens to you," Garner says. "He won't always tell you yes, but he will explain why he had to say no." In talking about what kind of candidate the WakeMed board should look to hire, Bensel says it's still too early to talk specifics. "I think it's the best available candidate, whether that's someone here or someone from across the country," he says. "Knowing the market has its advantages, but coming from other markets has its advantages as well. Because of the financial struggles from last year and the tough financial landscape facing WakeMed and other hospitals in the coming year, Christian Hyman, Managing Director in charge of Executive Search at Vacaville Raleigh, an executive search firm, says the interim and full-time CEOs must be ready for a challenge. "You have people that are really good and really enjoy challenges, and that could be a good fit here," he says, contrasting this position to the CEO of a company with fairly consistent year-over-year results who must, more or less, just keep the ship steered in the right direction. Also on the subject of hospitals, e-records hurt hospitals' bottom lines this year. Two of Wake County's major health care systems are planning to post nearly break-even operating budgets, reflecting some of the major changes in health care finances effective this year and next. Ideally, hospitals would like to run about a 4% profit margin. That gives them enough financial breathing space to accommodate patients who can't pay. The budgets include estimates for uncompensated or charity care, but the hospital executives always say they need that extra financial cushion in case of a higher-than-expected number of patients without insurance who walk through their doors in emergencies. Playing a role in lowering operating margins this fiscal year is the installation of new electronic health record systems. These are the vast computer systems that store patient records and connect all tangents of a hospital system while allowing hospitals to share information. Healthcare experts say this will lower overall spending on healthcare because it will reduce duplicate tests. If a patient receives an X-ray at one hospital and the next week enters a different hospital, those doctors should be able to see the test results from the initial X-ray without a second expensive procedure. This week's column from Lauren Onisorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. Her lead article is "Insects Welcome in This RTP Work Environment." The basement of BASF's newly expanded campus at Research Triangle Park houses a center that's not for the faint of heart, BASF's new insectory. Expect the whir of insect wings, a buzzing mosquito, the scratching of a cockroach. The structure, designed by BASF's Bill Fisher, is capable of producing 2 million insects. Specifically, the creepy crawlies primarily include 15 species, including those giant cockroaches that even now might be slithering through your house. But on occasion, other insects for temporary experiments will be housed there too. And while it's technically in the basement, the new facility is a point of pride for the BASF team, who talk about it any chance they get. Fisher says a facility has to be carefully controlled so BASF can create perfect specimens, perfect for the experiments that could one day lead to products that will get rid of them. If conditions aren't correct, the cockroaches could be the ones with the stress, and that would thwart research efforts. We've brought them into an unnatural environment, he says, noting that temperature and humidity constraints can put the animals under stress, making them susceptible to pathogens. Viruses can destroy a colony literally within weeks. I've seen that happen years ago in a different operation. In fact, it was that instance that led him to design his first insectary at Dow Chemical in 1972. That was the beginning, he says. The latest insectary will allow us more flexibility to provide the species the researchers need, he says. Nigel Arms, site lead at the RTP campus, says the new insect-rearing facility is an upgrade to what BASF had previously. Arms, who managed the insecticide research group when it started at RTP in 2012, says the higher level of quality control will speed research. Next up, Durham isn't the only party to benefit from the new Google relationship. Last month, Google named Durham as one of seven tech hubs in North America, a move that obviously puts the Bull City in the entrepreneurial spotlight. But what's in it for the technology giant? We ask Appia Chief Product Officer Jamie Fellows, who says technology adaptation is benefit number one. Startups highlighted by Google get Google technology. You build a company based on Google technology. If you go larger, you're going to continue to use that Google technology, he explains. The partnerships could also have entrepreneurs speaking Google's language, creating more attractive acquisition targets for Google, he points out. You build something off of Google technology, then they can pick and choose who they are interested in from an investment side, he says. But if Google's new initiative really does drive Android adaptation, will we see Apple tech hubs pushing to yank entrepreneurs back to iOS? It's not as much in their DNA, Fellows explains. Google is much more of a technology-based company. Not that Apple isn't, but they seem to be much more of a consumer-based company. This week's column of By the Numbers. An affiliate of Xerox Corporation, Xerox Commercial Services, has announced that 508 of its call center employees in Cary would lose their jobs. These reductions, while very difficult decisions, reflect the changing business requirements of our clients, says spokesperson Bill McKee. 508. Number of job cuts announced in September at Xerox Cary Call Center. 67. Number of job cuts announced at the call center in August. 1,500. Number of employees currently working at the Cary Call Center. 3,200. Number of employees working in the Triangle. 4,400. Total number of Xerox employees in North Carolina. This week's column on regulatory issues and transportation is by Dawn Curry. Dawn's column is led by an article titled Women-Led Firms See Federal Contract Gains. Women-owned businesses are getting a larger piece of the $500 billion federal contracts pie. A recently released American Express survey reveals that women-owned firms spent an average of $112,112 in time and money in 2012 to pursue federal contracts. In comparison, firms owned by men spent $137,040 during the same period. It's not a big gap, says Sefi Asfina, founder and longtime president of Raleigh's SEPI Engineering Incorporation, a transportation engineering and planning services firm. There are still less women-owned firms. Women-owned businesses are outnumbered 10-1 compared to federal contracting firms owned by men. Federal contracting officials have been aware for a long time that there were fewer women-owned businesses looking for federal work, but it was only until that the government's Women-Owned Small Business, also known as WOSB, certification program started yielding positive results. The Amex report concludes 67% of women-owned firms find the certification useful when seeking contracts, up dramatically from 37% in 2010. According to Asfina, being WOSB certified gives women owners access to federal government tool that allows them to compete for contracts in a new bracket. Prior to that, you could only compete in other categories, but they never had anything for women-owned small businesses, Asfina said. That tool is a positive thing. It's a self-certification, and your business has to be a 51% women-owned business. Other categories include veteran-owned small businesses, service-disabled veteran-owned small businesses, hub-zone emerging small businesses, partial small businesses, partially women-owned small businesses, and economically disadvantaged women-owned small businesses. But there's a drawback, she says. It's still hard to land a contract because there aren't many requests for proposals coming out that specifically ask for WOSBs. We're hoping that we see more so. We don't have to compete with large companies, Asfina said. Also in Dawn Curry's column about regulatory issues is a new article called New Laws for You. It's entitled Guns on Premises and Food Lawsuit Defenses. Here are five new North Carolina laws effective October 1st that impact local businesses. Number one. Handgun permit holders can take their guns into restaurants and bars or events where admission is sold, unless otherwise posted. Number two, people who become obese or suffer health conditions due to obesity may not sue companies that comply with regulatory requirements for food labeling and distribution. Number three, self-storage owners with liens on personal property need to deliver a notice of public sale to the applicant by mail or email and must announce the notice commercially. The sale must then include an online component like an auction website. Late rental contracts will see an increased minimum late fee. Number four, contractors and building material manufacturers must comply with more energy-efficient standards for major building projects. New constructions and renovations must meet a higher standard than they did in 2004. And, number five, the state cannot require contractors to enter into a labor union agreement as a condition of performing work on public construction projects. Also by the numbers, buckle up. A Research Triangle Institute report states North Carolina drivers are buckling up on the roads more than ever before in some categories. 88.6% of North Carolinians were wearing seatbelts. That's a 1.1% increase from 2012. 92.4% of females wear seatbelts. 87.9% of men wear seatbelts. 85.5% of teenagers 16 to 24 wear seatbelts. And 87.4% of Wake County drivers wear seatbelts. Moving on to this week's small business column, Mercury Gate. Efficient global shipping starts with savvy software system. By Lauren Onisorge. For Monica Wooden, CEO of Cary-based transportation management software company Mercury Gate, growth, while exciting, is part of the challenge. Her company, founded in 2000, is a result of a project she started after a career at IBM. That was during the dot-com bust, she says. There was no money to be had to start a company, so basically I just started it myself with friends and family. In the first decade, Mercury Gate paced itself with good reason. Those were the years of $4 gas and uncertainty about fuel. But then in 2010 and 2011, we basically doubled everything, she says. Suddenly, instead of bringing on 10 customers a year, Mercury Gate was bringing in 50. And that required infrastructure. Mercury Gate went on its first hiring binge, going from 35 to 40 people. Ultimately, reaching the 140-person roster it boasts today. Wooden says the triple-digit employee base has always been a possibility. The demand has always been there, she says. We have just always controlled the growth. Until now. The test drive is over, and Wooden is ready to cruise down the metaphorical interstate. She's in the process of relocating the Cary headquarters from a 5,400-square-foot space to an 11,000-square-foot building. The new location, she says, can house the workforce required to get Mercury Gate to the $100 million mark, and she says she's ready. And she wants the growth to happen in the triangle. We draw a lot of graduates from NC State, she says. We also get a lot of the folks in the Northeast who want to get out of that area and move a little bit south. And that wouldn't be possible, she notes, if she were still in Florida. But with all the rapid growth, maintaining the culture is a daily concern. To do it, she puts the focus on the customers, not internal company politics. We're jeans and shorts, flip-flops and shirt, that kind of company, she says. Everybody's pretty relaxed with our customers. And the employees gather and carry once a year to get to know each other. For inspiration, Wooden looks to another leader, such as Carrie business leader Jim Goodnight, the CEO of SAS. He really stayed the course, he says. He bootstrapped it like we did. We have no investors. And both companies, she notes, grew over the long stretch. But SAS isn't her only comparison. She also thinks of Mercury Gate like Southwest when it first came to RTU. Southwest didn't take travelers away from Delta and United, she notes. What they did is they brought more people out to travel, she adds, saying that the idea that Mercury Gate is trying to emulate in the early growth phase, not to necessarily take customers away from the other transportation management firms, such as SAP, but to create a larger customer base. Her customers include Cardinal Health, U.S. Cold Storage, and Saddle Creek Logic Services. In one customer testimonial, Amy Proctor, Director of Logistics Sales at Trinity Transport, says Mercury Gate software helped Trinity save between 10 and 30% of its overhead expenses. Mercury Gate's marketing manager, Jennifer Fleury, says her company expects to hit $32 million in revenue for 2013 and anticipates $45 million in 2014. The company also hopes to increase its headcount by 200 by the end of next year. This week's column of Five Questions With is Dr. Laura Patel. Dr. Patel is the Hospice and Palliative Care Medical Director at Hospice of Wake County. The Triangle Business Journal posed her a series of questions and she answered them. TBJ, what is the best piece of business advice you ever received? And Dr. Patel replies, if you don't know, ask. Never assume. Surround yourself with people who are smarter than you, those who can challenge you and inspire you. TBJ, what accomplishments are you most proud of from the past year? Dr. Patel, I am most proud of my continued growth and willingness to take on challenges, personally and professionally. As a mother, I rose to the challenge of caring for my young daughter who has severe food allergies. This involved reinventing the way I cook and bake, so now I feel like an expert in an allergy-free kitchen. Over the past year, I sought out opportunities for continued learning and skills acquisition, which allowed me to be in a position to join this great organization of Hospice of Wake County. TBJ, what are some top-of-mind goals that you are looking to achieve in the next year? Dr. Patel, I hope to improve our ability to reach patients earlier in their disease. So often patients are referred to us with only days or sometimes even hours of life left, and the patient and family do not experience our full continuum of care. We will continue to work to provide education to community and the medical system at large to facilitate the earlier use of end-of-life services. TBJ, what is the most important thing families can do to prepare themselves for placing a loved one in hospice? Dr. Patel, there is often a misperception of accepting end-of-life services as evidence of giving up, or there's nothing more we can do, when in fact the opposite is true. Hospice of Wake County is all about providing intensive comfort care to make sure that each day is lived as one that contains hope and light. And finally, TBJ asked, what do you see as the biggest need for Hospice of Wake County? And Dr. Patel answers, I would like to strengthen our palliative care programs, building on our strong partnerships with local hospitals, nursing facilities, and primary care physicians. This week's op-ed page features Dawn Curry, who covers regulatory issues and transportation for the Triangle Business Journal. This is from her reporter's notebook and is entitled, New Beat Offers New Opportunities. When people ask me what I cover for the Triangle Business Journal, I get a lot of blank looks when I say I follow the regulatory environment in the state. Just what is the Reg Beat? I'll be digging into laws, rules, and regulations at the local, state, or federal level that could have an effect on how business functions, particularly in the Triangle. My goal is to deliver news that informs our readers about changes in the regulatory environment and how those changes might affect job prospects, capital investment, and management decisions. I'll also be reporting and analyzing the broader impact on the local and regional economy. Transportation is my secondary beat, always an exciting coverage area since it's ripe with great stories from the airports, roads, and rail systems. How am I going to find good stories? That's the question I ask myself every morning since moving to Raleigh. Above all, my goal in this post is to open the dialogue with readers and business owners. I like researching various topics, but research alone cannot generate the types of stories we like to write about here at the Triangle Business Journal. We need real voices, we need smart anecdotes, and we need intelligent analysts. After all, this is your paper. Help me tell those stories. Tell me your concerns. Direct me to your sources and allow me to understand what worries you about the new rules, laws, and directives. I want to hear from large and small business owners, lawyers, accountants, bankers, legislatures, and lobbyists. What issues do you feel have not received enough attention? As I mentioned before, transportation is the other area I'll cover in depth, reporting on planes, trains, and automobiles, perhaps even boats, and many other topics of interest to our readers. Key issues that intersect both of these main topics are things I want to know and write about. Changes in incentive policies, the government shutdown, and budget cuts will all affect business in some capacity. Whether an issue is bringing your business to its knees or making it soar, please share your tips. I'm easy to reach. Just email, tweet, or call and tell me what you think our readers need to know about the regulatory and transportation issues in the Triangle and in Durham and in North Carolina. Dawn Curry can be reached at dcurry@bizjournals.com. Her Twitter account is @tribizreg. By phone, she can be reached at 919-371-1015. This week's guest opinion is Mr. Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow at UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. His column is entitled Deeper Dive into Economic Stats Shows Some Healthy Rebound. The recovery from the Great Recession continues to grind along. Each new data release indicates improvement, but the gains are slow and insufficient to return us to pre-recession economic health. Let's drill down to get a fuller picture of this recovery. Low wages. Many observers claim that we're in a low-wage recovery. USA Today reported that 60% of job growth is in the low-wage sectors of retail, restaurants, home health care, and temporary staffing. In fact, the figure is more like 40% if viewed over the entire recovery. More importantly, none of this is surprising. Since the job market hit bottom in early 2010, private sector employment has grown 7%, while employment in these four low-wage sectors has grown 11%. But at this point, after the 2001 recession, the figures were 6% and 8% respectively. In the recovery from 1990-91 recession, they were 8% and 12%. In each of these recoveries, low-wage employment grew faster than employment overall. Why is this? Employers have great flexibility in their use of low-wage workers who are easy to fire and hire. In addition, many of these jobs depend on discretionary spending, which rises faster than spending on necessities as the economy recovers. So we can calm down. The job market is still weak, but it hasn't been transformed suddenly into a low-wage wasteland. Trading places. During the recession and most of the recovery, government jobs were safer than private sector jobs. In early 2010, the private sector hit bottom, having shed 8% of its workforce. But government, at all levels, not counting temporary census workers, was holding steady. Since then, the private sector has improved, while tight budgets have forced government to make job cuts. Private sector employment is nearing its pre-recession peak, whereas government employment is down more than 2%. Government employment is now the riskier option. Who's the real Keynesian? The shrinkage of government employment is unusual. At this point, in each of the Reagan, Clinton, and Bush recoveries after the 1981-82, 90, 91, and 2000 recessions, government employment was 5% higher than before the recession. The Obama recovery is running more than 7 percentage points behind that pace. If government employment were growing as fast as it did in the previous three recoveries, the national unemployment rate would be at least a point lower than the current 7.3%, and possibly with multiplier effects below 6%. The Reagan, Clinton, and Bush recoveries were fueled in part by Keynesian stimulus via government hiring. The Obama recovery is the one marked by government austerity and restraint. Hiring and firing. In both the U.S. and North Carolina, the number of initial claims for unemployment insurance is close to where it was before the recession. Mass layoffs are rare. Unfortunately, so are large-scale hiring announcements. The problem with the job market isn't too much firing, it's too little hiring. Looking ahead. In his most recent forecast, UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton predicted that 2014 will be a breakout year for the North Carolina economy, which will add 86,000 jobs next year. That would be a lot better in 2013. So far this year, employment in the state has only grown by 20,000. On the other hand, if 86,000 new jobs implies a breakout year, then we should have been more appreciative of 2012. Last year, the state economy added 90,000 jobs, and let's hope for a repeat next year. You should know that Fidelity isn't bugged about the RTP space it's going to occupy. Defense officials in Canada have gone back and forth as to whether bugs, aka listening devices, were found in what used to be a Nortel building in Ottawa. But regardless of whether the spy gear was found in Canada, Fidelity officials tell us that the Nortel campus they're moving into the Research Triangle Park is bug-free. Triangle Business Journal spoke to Fidelity spokesperson Adam Banker and asked whether it's typical for Fidelity to sweep buildings for security threats prior to move in. While it's our general practice not to discuss specific practices or matters, we can tell you that we are very comfortable with our facilities in North Carolina, says Mr. Banker. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.